Hi, Navratri and Puja, greetings to all. Welcome to episode 58 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, right here on the Talking Stuff Network. I am Vikram Mohan. This episode is sponsored by Sleep Spa. We sleep for an average of 25 years during our lifetime. Somebody like me probably can add an extra 5 years. So why not ensure that these years are some of the best ones of our life? One way to do that is to get a great mattress. So shop from the range of mattresses online. They have got memory foam to orthopedic to everything in between. My favorite though is their latex mattress called Nirvana, which is made of 100% natural latex. And this mattress has 7 different firmness zones that's customized as per the needs of each part of the body. If that sounds theoretical, trust me, it works great in practice. But you don't have to take my word for it. These guys are so confident about the mattress that they offer an 11-year warranty and also a 100 nights trial. I've never seen this before in India though. So consider gifting yourself or a loved one in India this gift of great sleep and energy, and order a mattress from sleepspa.in. You can use the coupon code TALKINGSTUFF15 and get 15% off. That should add the sweet dreams to your good night. We thank Sleep Spa for the support of the Talking Stuff Network. And speaking of sleep, I think it's pretty late for our host, even though he's on the West Coast. So I don't want to keep him up for too long. Hey, Arnab, how are you?
I'm doing fine. So before we start, I'd just like to announce that I will be attending Durga Puja for the next 2 weeks on Saturday night, which is when we normally record these episodes. So I will be going to the Valley Durga Puja, which is happens to be the Durga Puja that is in the closest driving distance to where I am. And this time it is they have decided to go with heavy 90s nostalgia. And as you know, I'm a sucker for the 90s. So I will obviously be there. They have Euphoria, which many of you even outside Bengal would know. Nice. Of and then they have Anjan Dutta, and so Anjan Dutta is an acquired taste, but I really love Anjan Dutta. So Anjan Dutta is, for you know, leave aside his movies, which are another thing, as a singer and as a popular singer, there was this genre of what was known as Jibon Mukhi Gaan when in the 90s when we were growing up. Jibon Mukhi means I don't know how to translate it. Basically means life affirming, I guess. So there's not a lot of life affirming things in Anjan Dutta's. It was basically depressing. You know, she left me for somebody else. That was mostly every theme of his song went like that. and usually because I'm poor and he was rich, and there was. But the fact is that I loved those songs.
Sounds like a Bengali Altaf Raja.
It sounds like a Bengali Altaf Raja, exactly. Sounds like a Bengali Altaf, but totally different genre. So this is more like Pete Seeger inspired. So there's a lot of guitar and stuff. So I heard his concert in Jadavpur University, and that was more than 20 years ago. So I'm looking forward to hearing him again. Yeah, he puts on a good live show. So
last year,
plus, as I said, it's majorly 90s nostalgia.
Yeah, last year you said that you don't, you know, attend too many of these. So it looks like somebody in the organizing festival has made it, at least going by the 90s theme, they made it their key goal to get you into the Pandal this year.
So it's, see, that's the thing. Normally without this kind of a thing, it's very difficult to motivate yourself to go to Durga Puja. But the fact is, I've moved to Los Angeles now, and so Los Angeles and generally California, this place has the best in terms of, I think they get the most crowd, so that's why it's more financially viable, I think, to bring the best in terms of artists. So I know that in November there is going to be, and I'm planning to go there too, in the Bay Area there is going to be a 90s throwback concert with Kumar Shanu, Alka Yagnik.
Yeah, they were in Hyderabad last week. I think it's they're touring the world.
And so I'm planning to attend that too. Again, as I said, just because that's like the high water mark of 90s nostalgia, right? Those three singers together. So It's just that I'm fortunate now that one of the good things among the many bad things of living in California is that you basically get the best of Indian talent. You would not normally not get it in Maryland. I used to stay for most of my life in the US. So that's why, a few months ago, I came to know after it was over that Bappi Lahiri was performing, you know, very close by. And I wish I had known, because I would have definitely would have gone then. Again, more or less 80s nostalgia, I would say, not so much even 90s. Okay, so coming to today's topic. So the first topic that I want to discuss today is, today we're going to have a topics. So it's not questions like it was last time. So the first topic that I want to discuss, which is really hot news here right now, is Trump's impeachment. So for those of you who like to follow U.S. elections and U.S. politics, and nowadays, I think that anybody who's politically engaged, even into the Indian political scene, has to consider global politics. I don't think that the world has moved towards a place where what happens in the U.S. definitely impacts what happens in the Indian political space, not so much in terms of how people vote, but in terms of how the media messages things. As I've said before, you know, when people talk about our founding fathers and stuff, even that language comes totally from the US political coverage. Much of the hate that is directed towards Modi comes basically reflected almost a search replace from topics written about Donald Trump. Even though they're absolutely not comparable in terms of not only just their mandate, but in terms of their background, in terms of what they have achieved, in terms of who they are. But the Indian media, because they're inherently lazy, likes to take well-written articles. It's the same thing that we saw in Bollywood also, that, you know, when somebody has a banana narrative in the West, why not just supplant it totally, just take it from here and there, replace a few names, add a few item songs, and call it India. So we've seen a lot of movies like that. We've seen Zindaan, we've seen, but now we see political discussions. So it's very important for those of us who, even if you're not interested in the US politics per se, and since I stay in the US, I am, is to consider, you know, what US politics implies for India. So for those of you who followed U.S. politics, you know that there's been an effort for the last almost 3 years to impeach Trump. So impeachment is essentially the worst that you can do to a president. You can't really fire a president, but Congress can impeach the president, which is essentially an attempt to fire him, to prove that he has been accused of a behavior which is not presidential. And that's the U.S. System where you have a balance of checks and balances, where the president is not the absolute authority, not a king. And there have been twice that impeachment proceedings have been, there was against Nixon and there was against Clinton. With Clinton, of course, the impeachment process procedure went nowhere. It was, you know, the crime that Clinton was accused of was, of course, nowhere close to what Nixon had been accused of. And none of them are really close to what Trump is being accused of. What happened for the last 3 years was that the Democrats, I won't say they sponsored, but they strongly supported this, so what is known as the Robert Mueller probe into Russia's alleged interference in the U.S. elections. And we've discussed this before, so I'm not going to go into it at great depth. But really, the accusation was that the Russian government under Vladimir Putin had essentially done the DNC email hack. So they had hacked Hillary Clinton's emails and had, and this was not just a hack. This was a targeted hack, which did not target the Republicans, but it targeted the Democrats as a way of swinging the US elections. Then this was not just the only accusation, but there was also the accusation that Russians had set up these fake news farms, which they had gamed the Facebook algorithm so that people were fed misinformation. So overall, the accusation was that the Russians had worked in close collusion with Trump. And anybody with any iota of common sense would see that that was essentially true. The Russians did not hack the voting booths. So ultimately, it was Americans who voted. But the Russians did did do a huge campaign of misinformation. And even though it could not conclusively be proved, but the evidence was very strong that there was coordination and collusion between the Russian government and, again, not Trump directly, because of course he will never do it directly, but essentially wonder whether it was the person who was heading his campaign at the time who were clandestinely meeting the Russians. Now, what in this case, what happened was the Mueller probe essentially said that we don't have any proof. We don't have any solid proof to proceed on an impeachment. I mean, he didn't put it in these words, but the basic thing is that there are two accusations against Trump. One is that he colluded with the Russians. That, you know, we have some, you know, these are the incidents, but we can't really conclusively prove that Trump, not his campaign, but Trump was cognizant of this. We cannot prove that. However, the case is much stronger that Trump obstructed justice, which is that Trump did not let or created a lot of interference or tried to derail the probe. Now, of course, once you show that, then of course, by extension, you show that why would somebody do that unless that person isn't guilty? So that's really by extension. It's a second order proving of guilt. So the Trump, the Mueller report was much more emphatic on that. However, it stopped short, and which is why the Democrats and many of the progressives cried foul, that it did not say, please go ahead and impeach Trump. Again, this was kind of a wrong accusation to make against Mueller, because that was not really Mueller's job. Mueller could not recommend something like that. That has to be a decision taken by Congress. So once Mueller's report came out, there was, of course, the central part of the party, which is led by Nancy Pelosi, realized that there is really not much evidence that they could go by in order to do an impeachment. And what they were afraid of was that if they started an impeachment proceedings, while it would kind of be a raw dead meat to their party base, ultimately, if they cannot prove it, then Trump will this will secondly it will give him what Trump really wants. He wants the headlines, because Trump has realized that in this day and age it's not important whether you're in for the worst thing is absolute it's actually not being in the headlines at all for any reason. And this is something which Trump, as a reality show star, understands better than most people. That's the main thing. So, you know, the moderate sections, the more level-headed section of the Democrat Party were not in favor of impeaching Trump. They felt that it was better that they don't impeach Trump and that Trump will, in general, lose the next election. So why even bother? Till, of course, this latest scandal, which is kind of related, but not really, which was that there was a whistleblower who came out and said that he was a CIA operative, and he heard that Trump was in a call with the Ukrainian president, in which he essentially said that he basically was pestering the Ukrainian president to investigate Joe Biden's son, who had made some deals in the Ukraine. And the way this whole thing was messaged was that if you don't do it, they were withholding military aid to the Ukraine. So it was made very clear that if you want military aid to be restored, mind you, Ukraine is against Russia. So, you know, there's the Russian angle coming here again, is that, you know, essentially Trump is working as a proxy for the Russians. But it's also saying, well, you know, I'm really an employee of the Russians, but, you know, even more important than Russians is me. So I can get you off the hook with the Russians if you just help my personal lawyer. It's not even somebody from the US government, but my personal lawyer, if you give him access to whatever files you have to really screw Joe Biden's son. essence Joe Biden, who at least at that point of time he felt was his biggest opponent. Now, at least in the numbers, Elizabeth Warren has gone ahead. But I think it's more reasonable to assume that ultimately it will be Joe Biden who will be given the Democratic nomination. I don't think that you know, the Nancy Pelosi's of the world will really want Elizabeth Warren to be the face of the Democratic Party, because they might lose a lot of Wall Street donors if that happens. And some Wall Street donors have actually explicitly said that they will stop supporting the Democrat Party and stay away if Elizabeth Warren is their nominee. So money talks, and the Democrats, like any other political party, for far left people to rail against corporations. But centrist Democrats know that you cannot run a country like the US without corporations. Anyway, so now, once this has come out, and I don't think there is anybody in the White House that can deny, I mean, the official transcripts have been made available, and it's there in black and white. Trump is actually asking.
This is all on record. I didn't know that.
All on record. And so what Trump's lawyers did is immediately they took those meeting minutes and they called it classified. There was nothing classified in it except Trump making a threat, and they put it in that secret place that, you know, is not open to public scrutiny until and unless. And US has these whistleblower laws, so which says that if somebody inside says that something is being covered up, then you have to investigate. And so this guy basically used the whistleblower law. First, the Trump government tried to, you know, obviously tried to prevent him from speaking. And this is technically against the law. So if somebody whistleblows anywhere, this is not just in Trump, anywhere, in any federal agency, if you whistleblow, if you say, I'm seeing something, which in US has very strong whistleblower protections, not just in the government, but also in private industry. If you see something which is egregiously unethical, you have the right, and there is usually, you know, every company or every arm of the federal government has to keep this kind of independent structure to investigate whistleblower complaints. This was actually came through that whistleblower complaints, and they had to make the minutes available, even though it was redacted. But even what came out is pretty damning. And now Nancy Pelosi is saying yes, for this we can impeach. Because now they realize that this one they can make stick. Because this is, if you look at it in a scale of, on the notion of scale, it is nothing compared to what Trump was being accused of having done with the Russians, which is essentially compromise US interests to arguably US's biggest historic enemy. If you look at it, it's a much minor thing. It's obviously corruption. Again, you have to understand where Trump is coming from. Trump is coming from New York real estate, right? Which has typically been the playground of the mafia. So this is exactly the way the mafia does things. That is, hey, give me the dirt on Joe somebody, and if you do it, then this will good thing happen. If you don't do it, then bad things happen.
This is literally the first scene in Godfather, isn't it?
Yes, your horse will wind up dead, essentially. So this is really what Trump is trying to do. Now, the thing with Trump is because he's so out of control, and because he's gotten away with so much, it's so much more that you kind of feel invincible. And so Trump's first reaction was, if it was so damning, why would I have even said it publicly? But that's the thing with Trump. He's kind of gone, even if you remember, he had publicly in a rally said, Russians, if you're hearing this, go and hack into DNC's emails. And they went and hacked into DNC email, Hillary's emails. Now, his main thing was, if I was colluding, why would I say it in a rally in front of everyone? I said it and they picked up on it. It was not but that's always been his trick. His trick has been, say it out loud in front of everyone. And then it's no longer a secret. Except he didn't do it this time. This time he actually said it in a secret, in a quasi-secret environment, and then his underlings tried to cover it up by trying to make it so that nobody ever comes to know of it. So his main cover, see, the whole deal with everything is he's always, if there's nothing wrong, this is just the way I am. You know, I'm having affairs with porn stars. You know, my wife knows, everybody knows, this is no secret. You know, what is it to you? unlike Bill, he has never tried to kind of hide his you know, character behind this wall of propriety, which bizarrely has been his biggest strength. Because people say, okay, you know, even his most conservative Christian people say, you know, yeah, of course he's a characterless human being. But he says that, you know, he's not trying to hide it. You know, he's a characterless guy. But who cares? But that's always been his shtick. But this is the first time when he made this mistake, where rather than, it's a kind of minor thing compared to what he's done, which kind of, you know, brings you to Al Capone. You know, ultimately Al Capone was, you know, put to bars not for murder but because of tax evasion. So, you know, the biggest ruffians, the biggest mafia people, often they're much better in covering up their bigger crimes than for the small ones, because the small ones, they kind of, you know, go through the cracks. And now that Trump has, this one's fallen, now Nancy Pelosi has gone after it. She said, okay, now this one I'm going after, because this one I think I can nail him on this. And it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But I, and again, Trump has, of course, squeezed by. And he's there was a guy called the Teflon Don. And I think Trump is the version of the Teflon Don. So it'll be interesting to see how Trump gets by on this. Because I think this, I also think, based on what I've said, that this is going to be really tough for him. Because there's written evidence, unlike Russian, where it was all circumstantial evidence. It was always a second guy. It was always Trump's lawyer, who was in any case a sleazy crook, who was, you know, testifying against him. So they could always say, you know, he's a sleazy crook. And you would wonder why that sleazy crook was Trump's lawyer. But anyways, so all the kind of deposition that came against him came from extremely sleazy sources. So they could all be deprecated. But in this case, that is not true. This is part of official presidential minutes. So you cannot say this didn't happen or this guy is a liar. So you cannot do that. That's off the table at this point of time. So it'll be very, very difficult for Trump to wriggle out of this, because this is technically a violation of the law that you cannot use. And I'm pretty sure now many Republicans are saying, oh, the Democrats have done this also. I'm pretty sure they have. I'm not saying that they haven't. I'm pretty sure this is the way politics works, that those in power essentially use their power against their political opponents in different shapes or form. But whatever they've done, whatever the Democrats might have done, they didn't do it this stupidly. So ultimately, I think Trump might be buried by, ultimately, not by his malfeasance, but more by his stupidity in this case. So the second topic that I want to do today is, of course, last week's Howdy Modi. By the way, I wasn't there. I didn't want to be either.
Yeah, you did clarify it last week.
Yes, too. I wasn't there and I didn't want to be there either. But I think...
Okay, but here's the question. Were you outside with Hasan Minhaj?
I was not outside. I was not outside with Hasan Minhaj at all. I thought it was very funny with what they did to us. So this is the kind of idiotic thing that, you know, people do. Why would you not let Hasan Minhaj come in? I don't think this helps. I mean, Hasan Minhaj is there precisely for this reason. He's there in Jadavpur University to do bawal. Okay. Bawali ko test. Okay. That's what he's there for. And why would you help him? Of course, you might have pulled a stunt there, but at least there you can say it's security. But you have to allow, if he has a press pass, and if you tell him, oh, look, we're not allowing in because you've said bad things about India, that's exactly what Hasan Minhaj wants to hear. So Hasan Minhaj, you gave, this is the idiocy of those people who are handling this whole thing. If you gave Hasan Minhaj, and while at the same time inside in the organization, inside in the event, feting him as an example of a successful Indian American, you're not letting him come in. You're giving Hasan Minhaj the perfect, you know, 30-second, 90-second hook for one of his segments. I mean, he couldn't have written it better himself. I mean, on one hand, you are elevating him by showing him as an example. Okay, Whether that's a good idea or not, I don't know. Let's not comment on that. But you've decided to call him as an outstanding example of an Indian American in a Modi event. And then you decide not to let that same guy in. There's both things cannot happen at the same time. Let's just put it like that. I mean, this is just, you know, this is basically digging their own grave. Okay, so second was the Howdy Modi. The only thing that I want to talk about was what I said at that point of time was that even before the event, that Trump will talk to Imran Khan and then he will say a totally different thing. It's exactly what happened. Because, you know, Trump, as all of us know, is he works on two principles. How is this benefiting me or is this stroking my ego? So whoever strokes his ego, and his memory is very short because he's not a very smart guy in that respect. So, you know, his mind is like a 5-year-old. So, you know, whoever stroked his ego like 5 seconds ago obviously gets higher priority. But what one thing that I think that really good thing that came out of Howdy Modi, and only, you know, Modi's, you know, Trump's, you know, calling Modi the father of India. And then I think the biggest compliment, I think the biggest compliment he gave him was he called him the America's Elvis. He meant India's Elvis, of course, but he called him America's Elvis. So I think that's a bigger compliment. And I think this is really where the utility of Howdy Modi is. So Howdy Modi is the first time that India as a community have kind of become part of the mainstream of US politics. Whether it starts with, Bernie Sanders using a pan-Islamic front, using a platform provided by an Islamic organization to criticize India on Kashmir, you know, essentially endorsing the communalization of Kashmir. This one basically is a counter move to that. And I think the biggest thing that comes out of this is that Modi shows Trump the thing that he understands is that Modi has popularity. See, Trump, if you read his tweets, in his mind, the biggest put down that he can ever give anyone is your ratings are bad.
Yeah, bad ratings. Yes.
Bad ratings. You are not a 10. So everything about him is metric on popularity. So his entire worldview is that. And I think that Modi, it doesn't matter what Modi does. There's only very simple thing that Trump can understand. It's the kind of privileged white guy who grew up in the US, insanely rich. That's the only thing he can understand is that guy's car flashier than mine? Is the only currency, is the only thing he can understand. And what Modi showed him is, yes, it is. I am a bigger star than you are in my country. Look at the amount of, and Trump got that. The only thing that Trump really understands is popularity. And Modi was able to show that, you know, he is a bigger rock star than Trump. He gave Trump, you know, his space in the sun. But he also made it clear that, dude, these guys are here for me. So do you realize what a big deal I am? If, you know, such a country with such a small number of Indians, we can fill a stadium like this, you know, calling out my name like a rock star. Can you imagine what I am in my own country? So that is what impresses Trump. And that, I think, is important. I think it's important that in diplomacy, that it doesn't matter how Trump came into power. It doesn't matter whether Trump is legitimate, he's good or bad. It doesn't matter. In the domain of diplomacy, what's important is that Trump is the president of the United States. And it is imperative for diplomats and for our prime minister or foreign ministers to be able to speak in the language that makes sense to the president. For years, the criticism of Indians' foreign policy is that Indian interlocutors in the foreign relations space tend to hector, tend to give gan, tend to kind of come across as holier than thou, kind of not speak in diplomatese, but essentially go and say, we are good and you are bad, we are moral. See, this doesn't work. This is the whole Nehruvian approach. Now, this might be the higher ground approach. This might be the good guy approach. It doesn't really matter. I think ultimately what matters in international diplomacy is, are you able? It is not just a question of international diplomacy. You know, when I write a book or, you know, when you make a presentation to your boss, the main thing that matters is not really the content of the presentation or how good you are or how good this book is. It is, are you able to connect? Are you able to connect? Are you able to create a moment? Are you able to create an emotion? Because ultimately people, they take decisions, they vote, they do it through emotion. They don't do it based on numbers. This is the you know, myth that people like to believe, that, you know, management decisions or, you know, even things at the level of countries are made by based on numbers and based on, you know, self-interest of the nation. There is no self-interest of the nation. When one person is making a decision, he doesn't represent the nation. Ultimately, what matters to him is the emotion that's in him or her. And in this case, given the kind of person, and that's one of the problems with Trump. I think Obama a long time ago said that, you know, you don't want possibly it was Obama, that, you know, here's a person whom you can bait with a tweet. I think what Obama was trying to say is you're putting the number one job in the country to somebody who's so easily emotionally manipulated. You just need to send him a tweet and he will react to it. He's the friggin' president of the country. So, you know, what they were saying is that the American president has to be smart enough to not react to things which other people normally would react to. So I personally absolutely react to flattery. If you come and tell me that mine is the scariest book you've read, I'm your best friend. But that's why I'm not the US president. Okay, that's why I'm not. But Trump is. It's Trump's, you know, to make a connect with Trump, it's that shallow, really. It's that shallow. So I think Modi was able to do that. And I think this was a victory in terms of, it's a very rare Indian diplomatic victory of the kind that normally doesn't happen. It's normally a diplomatic victory is a closed door thing. This is a very, very open forum thing. But I think that Modi was able to speak in the kind of language that Trump understands.
Arnab, in fact, just continuing on the same thing, even in the United Nations, if you contrast, Modi's speech with Imran Khan's, Imran Khan went on, I mean, depending on how you perceive it, at least for 45 minutes talking about RSS, talking about India, JNK, whereas Modi just took the high ground. There is not even a mention of Kashmir or Pakistan.
Yeah, so
this
so
is this, a the, new kind of diplomacy.
I wouldn't say this is particularly new. I think this is, I mean, again, I don't want to overstate the innovativeness of Modi. I don't think this is the thing. I think the thrust of Indian foreign policy for the last years, in a few years, even before Modi, has been to dehyphenate ourselves from Pakistan. I think we want to show to the world that Pakistan is, we don't even care about them. You know, we're not even here to talk about them. You know, they're an irritant. Yeah. You know, they cause trouble. But that's not the be all and end all of our existence. We don't define ourselves by them. You know, we have other things to do. Yeah, they're there. But, you know, we're not you know, we can handle them. So this
Unfortunately,
shows...
I think nobody sent out that memo to our press, because all the questions they asked Trump, everything was about Imran Khan or about Kashmir.
So that's because our press is, of course, you know, our press is as they are. I mean, it's like flogging a dead horse to kind of expect anything better from our media. But I think what's important is that while Imran Khan was, of course, you know, that's what happens when you submerge yourself with black lentil, is that he decided to do the worst thing possible. He decided to essentially define Pakistan purely as something which exists as a counter to India. His everything was, dekho bhaiya, ye kutte mujhe cheer rahe hain, from Gunda. So, you know, his entire thing had about the same kind of intellectual heft as a dialogue from Chutia in Gunda. And it's, of course, the only people who will take that seriously are people in the Indian media, paradoxically. But other than that, this comes across as somebody who is absolutely unable to do anything. So he starts off by saying, of course, you won't listen to us. You only care about India and its economic might. Dude, you just said the truth now, right? So you're in a way, if your whole thing is kind of, you're coming to the UN, you have 15 friggin' minutes, and your entire thing is complaining about your neighbor, you just come across as somebody who's unable to protect yourself. And you already started making excuses for your failure inside that 15 minutes itself. And this is so different from the kind of speech that Vajpayee, for instance, gave years ago. You know, there was a time when we were not a big power economically. There was a time in which we were not much different from Pakistan, actually, in terms of our influence. But the big thing is that our leaders understood that that is not the way we can message it on a public forum. That we always have to take the high ground. It could be that we are worried about Pakistan. That might be the truth, but that doesn't mean that we lead with it. We should bury the lead in this case. And I think that we have reached a point where we really shouldn't care about Pakistan. We should, even as a nation, we should know that, okay, this is a nation which will try to do these things because that's really what they're obsessed about. They're obsessed about whether India's Chandrayaan 2 makes the moon. They're not obsessed. They don't care whether they have never done anything. You know, they've even given up on that. They're not even saying that, look, you know, we have done nothing. So their entire thing is, the entire national goal is feeding off India's failures. Then they can't beat us in cricket anymore. That's the only thing they were good at, in which they were, you know, when we were growing up, there was no way they were a much better team. They're not even that now. So I think they have absolutely no domain, no sphere in which they can say that they dominate India or even that they come close to competing with India in any shape or form. And I think we in India, one of the things we need to do is we also need as a country to kind of give them less importance, not to like kind of be baited or by a tweet made by their science minister or someone, or their minister of human rights. I mean, they have a minister of human rights. This is like Captain Haddock being the chairman of Society of Sober Sailors. So, but before we proceed, how much time do we have left? Because this might be a little long.
No, we've done just a little more than 30 minutes so far.
Okay.
So 35 minutes.
Okay, so the third topic that we wanted to talk about today was the environment, which of course came up with the very viral Greta Thunberg. What was it? Are you ashamed or something? You know that.
How dare you?
How dare you? How dare you?
How dare you?
How dare you? How dare you look at us for hope and everything? So before we go into it, and I've studiously, avoided making a comment on this because it's just impossible to make a comment and not to come back as you're against women, which it isn't. I mean, nothing.
Or the environment or both.
Environment or both. So first of all, before we start, let's me start off with saying this, that I absolutely, absolutely endorse what she says, not how she says it. But I am very, very pro-environment. I don't think anybody with half a rational mind and with any training in science, and forget science, any training in any elementary schooling would say that climate is not a crisis. I think the science on that has been conclusively proven. I think this is like saying that this, you know, the earth is flat, you know, denying climate change is like saying that the earth is flat or that the earth is the center of the solar system. So at this point of time, this is not a defense of anti-environmentalism. But before we, this is, and it's not even, Greta Thunberg is not important in terms of what we're talking about here, which is the environment. But before we talk about the environment and before I come to my point, let's start off with something which was totally different, which is Tagore's criticism of the Swadeshi movement. So in his very famous novel Ghore Baire, Rabindranath Tagore, it was a very controversial novel in which he essentially criticized the Swadeshi movement. I may have covered this before in a previous podcast, but since we've had many podcasts and I'm pretty sure everybody hasn't listened to every podcast episode, let's just go over what his criticism of the Swadeshi movement was. This is actually what in the future led to this whole canard that Rabindranath Tagore was not patriotic or that he was like a British stooge. This is really where the whole origin of this started. So Rabindranath Tagore, essentially what he said was that, so this was happening in Bengal started in the 1920s, was that the Swadeshi movement was saying you have to adopt as you all of us know, you know, Indian made goods. And the way it started off with cloth, it started off with burning. So those of you who remember seeing Gandhi, it started off with burning Manchester made cloth. So Rabindranath Tagore's objection to that was that you cannot first burn something without putting in a viable option in place. To which the counter was, oh, but we are spinning cloth. Okay. Gandhiji is spinning cloth. To which Rabindranath Tagore himself, a zamindar and elitist, said, look at who's spinning cloth. It's all rich people. People who have nothing to lose, who do not have to worry for their income, stay at home and spin some cloth. So this was their version of social media activism in those days. Essentially, people who have nothing to lose, you know, spinning some cloth and wearing it. But this was not a viable commercial enterprise. You could not sell that cloth because it took too much time. The only thing which poor people could buy was Manchester cloth, which was made by mills. And the people who were engaged in that trade were Muslims. So he made it very clear that the way this is going to come out is it's going to be come out as Hindu upper caste, zamindar class is trying to take away the livelihood of Muslims. This is how it's going to come out as what you're doing. Because I get what you're trying to say, but ultimately, if you put the gun of patriotism on somebody's head and say, you have to burn the cloth. So what happened was that the Muslim traders started to say, we will not burn cloth. How can we burn cloth? This is our business. And then the Congress went around and said, no, because you're not patriotic. That's why you're not burning cloth. And that has something to do with your religion. So this is how the whole communal conflagration in Bengal started. And this is exactly what was the theme of his novel. That there are two characters there. There is it's a kind of triangle love story where there is the zamindar who represents basically Rabindranath's opinion. Of course, he makes himself the hero, and his wife, and the zamindar's wife who stays in the Antar Mahal, stays in the inner chambers. The zamindar is a very progressive guy, and you know his wife when he says that you know she loves him, she says the only reason you love me is because you haven't ever met another guy, right? You know, how can I be worthy of your love if I mean I'm a monopoly? So what he does is he lets her meet his like very charismatic, idealistic friend, who happens to be a politician and very obviously based on Congress politicians. There's no other political party in town that. So this guy is, of course, he's an anti-hero, his patriotism is a ruse. In the movie that Satyajit Ray makes, he asks for people to burn British cloth, but he smokes foreign cigarettes because he says some things which of course I can't quit, because he's an elitist, because it's all in the pre-social media days, it's all about posturing, it's all about making other people feel guilty. And now we're kind of coming to the topic. So the thing with environmentalism is that, just like patriotism in the 1920s, it's something which I think all of us agree that it's a good thing. You know, you cannot have the British rule. But it's who is going to pay the cost? And ultimately, when whatever Greta Thunberg is saying, that's the problem with environmentalism. It's so impossible to live that life. If you come up and say, how dare you? Then of course, the focus will turn upon you and say, okay, how do you do things? And that's why those pictures of her having that, this plastic bottle and these things come out. And it's not her fault. It's just the fact that it is impossible in this day and age to live an environmentally sustainable life. Unless you are willing to, who can afford not to drink out of plastic bottles? Who can afford not to use, aircraft or transportation? Nobody, virtually. Unless you're so rich and you have so much passive income that you can basically, go to a cabin in the woods and plant trees all your life. I mean, that is the problem with being holier than thou on the environment. I think everybody understands, but the problem with environmentalism is the problem with preserving our environment is that it has to come with an enormous sacrifice. There's no way that we can avert environmental catastrophe unless we are prepared to cut off our arms and our legs. There's no other way. The only way to reduce weight in this case is to actually amputate ourselves. There is no other option, no matter how you message it. I think the outrage option is good to perhaps focus conversations. So in that case, Greta Thunberg, I mean, we're talking about environment because of what she did. So in that respect, it's good. The problem is, you know, focusing too much on her, because that's not really, you know, calling her out as a hypocrite is a low blow, I would say. Because I think everybody is a hypocrite. There are very few people say, oh, this person has, you know, planted 1,000 trees in her life. See, that is the environmental life. That is the only thing in their life. They have chosen poverty. So they have decided to cut off something. They have chosen poverty to do something for the environment. But they are a very, very restricted, limited number of people who can do that. And the thing is, many of these guys, they don't come up to you and say, you know, how dare you? They don't say that. They just do what they have to do. And ultimately, the tragedy is that, you know, them planting, you know, 1,000 trees or 1 crore trees is not going to make a difference, ultimately, because of the scale. And I think the progressives have realized that. I think the AOC New Deal, which is essentially... But the problem with leftists is that they have decided that let's use the environment, let's use the sacrifices that people will have to be asked to make to essentially do wealth distribution. To basically attain this holy grail of communism, which is to get rid of billionaires. Bernie actually even said it, get rid of billionaires. So again, billionaires is all of us, since none of us are billionaires, we can all agree that, you know, billionaires are, let's get rid of billionaires. Because, you know, who will... Ultimately, how many billionaires are there? Remember Bernie, you know, I had shown a screenshot many years ago, used to get rid of millionaires. Then he became a millionaire himself. This was, you know, when we were growing up, people said, oh, Hindi movie, they say, oh, Lakhpati hai. That was like the height of like evil, Lakhpati hai. Now everybody's a Lakhpati, so nobody is now, it's Karodpati, Arabpati, whatever. So, of course, it's always this other guy. This billionaire, this guy who we cannot attain, he has to pay for all the environment. Main toh nahi karunga bhai. I can't do this. So that is the thing with environment, is that nobody, and we can't expect. So what is an environmental solution? People say, you know, put a carbon tax. Essentially, make gas like 5 times more expensive. How? Okay. Will this reduce the consumption of gas? No, maybe it will to an extent. But who are going to pay for it? Everybody's going to pay for it. The poor are going to pay for it. The poor and the rich are going to pay for it equally. Which is, at that point of time, the progressives will come in and say, no, that's not the way. Poor shouldn't pay the same as the rich. The rich should have to pay more. Okay? How should the rich pay more? And who exactly are the rich? Should the rich in India pay the same as the rich in the US? Are all countries equally responsible for getting us to the stage that we are in? Now, the Americans say it, Americans in the developed countries say, it doesn't matter. You know, who's to blame? You know, we all have to do this. If we don't do this, then we're not going to meet the environmental targets. Countries like India, which, you know, China, and say, you know what? You guys decided to pollute. You guys decided to take a step ahead. And now when we are trying to do the same thing, you are basically saying you can't do it because of the environment. So this is, environment is essentially a tool that you're using to maintain your leadership in the world. So this is not about the environment. This is you using something, using a common fear that all of us have to essentially assert your supremacy and to make sure that your supremacy is never challenged. So again, this is such a difficult topic to even deal with, at the level of nations, at the level of individuals. I mean, most of us do not live an environmentally sustainable lifestyle. I mean, again, that's why I will never hector anybody else for anything. I mean, I eat meat. Eating meat is not environmentally sustainable. I mean, that's the science. It's not a question of, I mean, I'm nowhere close to being vegetarian or a vegan, but I mean, I was just looking at a recipe for mutton biryani. I mean, of course not. But the fact is, that's why, I mean, while I recognize that you know, the environment needs to be saved. While I understand, and I'm not going to deny it, or I'm not, and I read about the environment, the data is there. I mean, this is not made up. I mean, the polar ice caps are melting. People are standing on ground where they couldn't stand because there would be ice there. You know, penguins are falling off because their glaciers have melted. There's no place to stand anymore. I mean, there are pictures. It's happening right in front of us. There's no denying of it. And we all of us know what's going to happen as a result when the ocean level rises. You know, who's going to get submerged. But the fact is, and maybe the point of Greta Thunberg is not so much her. It's not so much trying to show that she's a hypocrite, because I think all of us are, in with some exceptions. The point is that it's impossible for Greta Thunberg, who's obviously somebody who thinks about the environment. And we have to applaud, you know, a 16-year-old girl for thinking about the environment. That's definitely something which is worth. I mean, maybe her messaging might be a little aggressive, but also you can argue that if she was not aggressive, then it wouldn't have caught the attention of people. So that works both ways. But I think that the focus should not be on Greta Thunberg or showing whether she's a hypocrite. It doesn't matter. It should not be sure whether Al Gore is a hypocrite. You know, Al Gore is not a girl. Al Gore is not, you know, he's a privileged white male. He's a vice president of US, and he's been made fun of because, you know, he flies in a private jet, which is, you know, God knows what his carbon footprint is, telling, wagging fingers in everybody's faces and saying, you have to do this. You have to do this. But I'm here in my private jet. And again, I can make fun of him because I'm not Al Gore. If I hector you and say, but you eat meat. So ultimately, that is the problem with the environment. The problem is that since it's everyone's problem, it's basically no one's problem. And this is, again, this is not something new. You know, years ago, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, Plato, he came up with this, you know, this utopic nation state, in which essentially the dream of AOC and Bernie, which is essentially super socialism, but in a very democratic way. You know, that's why Republic is a great book. It talks about, you know, it's a super state, and one day we will discuss the elements of Republic. You know, Arnav can talk about Republic. So right. And there, you know, Plato talked about this utopic nation state where there was this whole notion of a common ownership and everything. And then Aristotle came along, who was kind of a disciple of Plato, and said, this all is BS. This can be nothing like this. And Aristotle was, you know, totally, and again, people hate Aristotle because he was, you know, people say that Aristotle was essentially somebody who justified autocracy and your dictatorship. And that's not a true characterization of Aristotle, by the way. I mean, he did not say that. But one of Aristotle's criticisms of Plato was that if there is no notion of ownership, then, you know, nothing is anybody's problem. You know, if you say that the nation state has certain common things that people need to solve, in one respect, it's okay, but those common things will never really get solved, because and this was Aristotle's words, if something is everybody's problem, it's actually nobody's problem. And so this is really what has happened with the environment. I think everybody understands that something has to be done, but everybody knows that something will come at tremendous cost for that individual, regardless of whether he is rich or poor. Regardless, this will entail a fundamental changing of the way we breathe, of everything that we do. And it's also impossible to expect, which progressives do, is that the rich people will pay for it. This is impossible. It will be impossible to, and by doing this, the rich people obviously are not going to be the only persons who are going to pay for it. So by doing this, this actually diverts the conversation from what exactly can be done to an idealized state. So you have the new Green Deal, which is absolutely kind of fantasy. It's kind of like pollution erotica. It's like something which is, you know, environmental erotica. It's not something which looks good reading it, but it's obviously a fantasy. It can never be done, because it kind of puts
the whole onus, it not only it uses environmentalism as a way of basically recasting the entire world, which again is not going to happen. It's no, nobody is going to suddenly say, you know what, I'm going to stop eating meat. I'm going to stop taking, I'm going to burn my car. Either you can't even burn your car because that will also release a lot of gases into there. But I don't know what you can do with your car at that point of time. But, you know, I'm going to walk to work. I mean, I don't know how I will get rid of US is not going to transition to, let's say, a public transportation system. It's just not going to. It's not part of the nation's DNA. So the point that I'm trying to make is that how dare you? Again, everybody can say how dare you to somebody else. And the problem with it is nobody is willing to change their life. And in many ways, it's not possible when you have Greta Thunberg and you show her this picture of her having like the single-use plastic bottle. You know, you just cannot live without having single-use plastic bottles in this day and age. And she's a 16-year-old. It's natural. So for me, I think the more important message that comes out, and again, it's the cynic side of me, which says that ultimately, I don't think that there really is any solution for this. There is no single dictator. That the only way you can solve this is basically have a dictator which makes people essentially cut their hands and legs off, because nobody is going to do it by themselves. And again, we can't have a dictatorship. Will shame work? No, it won't work, right? It doesn't. It's never worked, because whenever somebody tries to shame you, you'll try to counter shame that person and you'll possibly have a good case for doing it. So, you know, that to me is really what comes out of this issue. And we don't talk enough about environment because it's not sexy enough, I guess. And definitely the first time I've mentioned in this show, and we've been doing it for a year, we've mentioned so many other issues of absolutely no significance in terms of the impact that environment will have. I think the US Army a few years ago came out, and US Army is not a collection of tree huggers. But they called the environment as the biggest threat to the U.S. national interest and to U.S. national security. So obviously, when you have like the military saying this, they're not Greta Thunberg who's saying that. So they're saying that, and the problem is real. It's real. You know, saying things like, you know, environment nahi badle, hum badal chuke hain. You know, that's BS. That's not true. Now, the question again is what are you willing to do? What are you willing to do about it? I'm not even willing to give up my meat. So, and I have no right to say how dare you to anybody. But giving up meat is the least of the things, really, that I know that I would have to do in order. And again, the reason why I don't do it is because I know that if I do it, it won't make any difference because the guy next to me is not going to do it. So this is the reason why, you know, this problem is so, so difficult to solve. But I'm glad in a way that, you know, this whole thing came up, because at least we're discussing it. At least me, the hypocrite that I am, like a lot of you, at least we're discussing this. We're talking about how, and I just don't feel that there is any way that we can solve in a democratic world order with no centralized. Again, as I said, you can have, you know, carbon tax, but, you know, if you do something like that, the poor will suffer the most. The poor in rich countries and the poor countries will suffer the most. I mean, there's really no ways around that. And that's the show for today. And again, I will be off for the next 2 weeks. So we will meet each other after 3 weeks.
That's, like you said, that's pretty much our podcast for today. And this is where I remind you about Arnab's Patreon page, where you can contribute directly to him. So head over to patreon.com/greatbong. And as Arnab said, since we're off for Dasara next week, we'll see you in 2 weeks. So until that time, take care.